Well, I've been sitting there for quite a while. And I've seen raffling taken to a new level tonight. But it's good to be here. And truly, you sit over there for a while and you're getting ready to get up here. You wonder if this is it now, and then it's not it, and then something else goes on. And it's very appropriate because it reminds me of a story that was told many years ago, and I tell it about every time I talk. They had a convention back in my home state in North Carolina many years ago. And they had one of these long-winded speakers. And he got up and talked the first hour on the 12 steps. The second hour he got into the 12 traditions. The third hour he got into three legacies and people began to leave. They will leave. I found it out one night and, true. And, sure enough, everybody left, but one man kept sitting on the front row. And the speaker got concerned, so he wound up his talk, ran down from the podium, grabbed the man by the hand, says, "I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you. Why'd you stay?" He said, "Hell, I'm the next speaker." Well, now you know how I feel, really. It's good to be here, and I want to thank the committee, all the hospitality that's been provided to me. I was at this thing in 99, I believe. Atlanta, I got a lot of friends sitting here tonight, I know. A lot of friends in the Atlanta area that passed on. That meant a lot to me and my sobriety, but it's good to be here and able to share and care with you for a few moments. Now, when you look at your watch, it don't mean much, but I noticed Bo all afternoon, he kept looking at his watch. Did y'all notice that? And I don't think he ever saw the hands on it yet. It's good to see Bo, and it's good to see some people that I've been around, and Beth, and then, of course, Tommy. It's good to see these people and still enjoying sobriety. And sorry Bill Roop is here tonight. But my name is Dave Cook. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Gratitude Study Group in Raleigh, North Carolina. By God's grace and because this program works for me, and through the help of some understanding sponsors that have led me with a kind and firm hand, through the help of some, and those sponsors, I want to talk a little about sponsorship tonight, I hope. But I never want to forget the sponsors. I'm on my fifth one. And I didn't kill them, by the way. They just had bad health. And by the love of two women in my life, my former wife, who some of you knew, passed away years ago, and my present wife, who some of you know, and through the help of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was September the 12th, 1957. And I don't give my sobriety date to impress you. Sometimes it impresses me when I wake up and realize it. Back when I first got sober, a lot of people resented people giving a sobriety date. You know, in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, by God, they'll shoot you right there. And the reason I give my sobriety date is where I came in the Alcoholics Anonymous. Although I'm a native of northeastern North Carolina, I got sober in Virginia, up in Roanoke, Virginia. The old Central Group. And the third meeting I ever went to in Alcoholics Anonymous was a discussion meeting. And they had 13 or 14 wicker chairs sitting in a circle. And I was no different from anybody else to go to that first discussion meeting. I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me. And it finally got to me. And the man who had become my first sponsor, although I didn't know it at that time, he says, "Give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you're qualified to do." And he explained to me for a while later on that's all I was going to be able to do for quite a while. And the second reason I give my sobriety date, in the old Central Group, they had a saying, if you remember that group, and if you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. So that's the reason I give my sobriety date. It's good to be here in your celebration of the miracle. And it's a word that we heard when we got to Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't hear it enough now. All of us are miracles, whether we admit it or not. You're looking at a miracle. You're looking at a miracle. A product of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I tell you my story, you're going to begin to wonder, how did he do it? And what does it really mean when he said that I'd rather be an Alcoholics Anonymous than be anywhere else on earth? I knew what drinking to do to a grown man. I saw what happened to my father. I didn't know my father was an alcoholic until I got sober in AA. Found out something about alcoholism. And my father was a good man as long as he didn't drink. You've heard that expression. And I was raised in a good Christian home. My mother loved me to death. I had two sisters and still have them. But it came a time in my mother's life when she got tired of it, and it led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And I chose to live with my mother. And so did my two sisters. And my father later died of alcoholic death. And I've often said that I wish he could have found Alcoholics Anonymous, because he would have made a good member. He would have made a good member because he liked to tell stories. He liked to lie a little. And, we stretch the truth once in a while, and he was good at that, but he would have made a good memory. He didn't have the opportunity to do it. My mother was able to send me off and get an education. And that's where I found out something about John Barleycorn. I was a freshman in college. Fellas just came back from World War II, knew how to drink on a GI Bill. And I was around these fellas, a lot older than I was. And I've often said, and I still believe it, that if you're in an environment and drinking, you stay in it long enough, you'll become a part of that environment. Same thing about sobriety. There are different sobriety environments, I think. And ever what you're in, if you become a part of it and stay in it long enough, you will adjust to that environment. And that's what happened to me around the big boys. I wanted to do what the big boys are doing, and I remember the first time I got drunk, old store-bought wine, and got sick. Don't remember too much after, but I remember one of the fellows, I used to hear him talk about the pleasure that came from drinking, and didn't quite understood what he was talking about because I was throwing up most of the time. And he said, Dave says, there's a little pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up, that's the pleasure. Well, I had to learn the hard way. And, you know, we work at becoming alcoholics. I remember I really worked it. Getting drinks down and holding them down, and you know how it was. And I look back at that stuff and say, my God, he was crazy. He was crazy. And we don't know it at that time. And that's the thing I don't understand about alcoholism. Even today, in my sobriety, the people that I work with and the people that I work with and the people that come in that door tonight or tomorrow or the next night in your group. And that's the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. And we just about die from it. And I was one of those fellows. I just about died from it. I went on through college and had a lot of fun drinking. Didn't know what a hangover was. I studied engineering, but because of my basketball ability, I was offered a job coaching high school basketball when I got out of college. And I look at it now with a little glory attached to it, and I don't know. I look back now, and alcoholism and glory kind of seem to go together. So I decided I'd coach for a while, and I did, and I had a lot of success in it. I really did. My drinking at that time was just when I first started teaching school and coaching was drinking on weekends and meeting some of my schoolmates at different cities where we'd have a drunk. We'd have a blowout and go back to work the next day, you know, get home on Sunday night and try to go to work the next week. And this went on for a while, and I fell upstairs in the coaching profession because after 2 years of particular school, I was offered a much larger school down further east. In my home state, I kept moving east. And you keep moving east in North Carolina, there's nowhere to go. And eventually that's what happened, but this school, I was very successful, but my problem was I began to have a lot of friends that were on the school board that I was able to be in their homes at night, weeknights, and they seemed to like to drink a little. And so it wasn't long before I had a place to go about every night and drink. began to lose a sense of responsibility and was called on the carpet several times, and of course you denied. And I did in the beginning, and I got in trouble with a man that tried to give me a good career and tried to help me all he could, but drinking got in the way. They called me one time and to talk to me about my drinking. Everybody in the community knew I was drinking heavy except me. And they talked to me seriously one night, and the school board members, too, that drank with me. And you know how we are. Someone was saying tonight that alcoholic is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Well, the alcoholic is cunning and baffling. And so I decided I'd get these people off my back. I'd divert their attention. So I decided to get married. I got a lady in the community I'd known about 2 weeks. And I proposed, and she accepted. And God, I look back at it sometimes, and this is alcoholism, really. And it's amazing to me how many people the alcoholic hurts. And this woman, it wasn't long before she found out what she was in for, and she had sense enough to get out of this marriage later on. It didn't last long because of the fact we stayed together a little over a year because of the fact, you know, we thought a divorce would be, well, the community wouldn't accept a divorce too well, and here we are. I'm the local drunk, and everybody knows it except she and I. And I got in trouble at this school. I had to take over a girls' basketball team in the middle of the year. The girls' coach had to go in service, and they asked me to take over this girls' team. Now, you got to understand something. By this time, I was going to these ball games drinking a little. Well, I wasn't drunk. I was just loose, you know, moving good. Real fluid, and drinking vodka, you know, it leaves you breathless, and I wasn't drunk, but I was loose, and I'd been in the habit. This was the first game with these girls. Had them in the huddle just before the tip-off, and I'd been in the habit of hitting the boys, you know. So I started hitting the girls on the rear. My God, I didn't know what had happened there for a minute or two. Parents started coming down out of the stands, and a lot of hell broke loose, and I found out what I was in trouble the next morning when the school board met, and they gave me a chance to leave this school. Not only was that was the cause of me drinking, leaving, but my drinking had a lot to do with it. And so in the next few months, I moved a little further east to another school. This school was the rock bottom of schools in that part of the country, and I was there for a reason, to see that this school was accredited, naturally. And the only way I can describe my drinking at that time, and I had to get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to start drinking. And I had booze then. So I could stop shaking. So I could get my, you know, take a shower, shave, and get my clothes on and go to school. Knew what was going to happen about 12. Shakes would start again. I'd have some in the gymnasium or some in the automobile. Take a few drinks to stop the shakes. To pray for 3 o'clock when I could get in the car and go back and drive into town. This was a rural consolidated school. This went on for 6.5 months, this drinking like that. And one day at school, the principal just stopped me in the hall. And we didn't have a conference about it. He didn't even call me in the office. He said, "Dave, we don't need you anymore." It was just that simple. "We don't need you anymore." And I left school that day. Of course, I was fired, although I didn't know it. Now, I'd experienced blackouts before. And I had been my mother at various intervals because of my behavior. And the family physician thought I was having a terrible time on my nerves. Sent me to a couple of... You know, when I came along, there were no such thing as treatment centers. There were drying out places. And I went to... 3 or 4 of the best on the East Coast at one time. My mother paid for it, and I enjoyed it, really, because we learned how to taper off. I don't know if you've ever tapered off or not, but I enjoyed tapering off. Just sip a little, and then you're drunk again. And I'd come back to these places and wear shape when I went. And so I knew a little about a blackout, but I never know prolonged black. But on this, when the day I left school, I experienced my first prolonged blackout. And it lasted a period of about 2 weeks. I later found out. I remember some of it and some of them I don't. But I remember waking up in jail for the first time in my life in the city where I was living. Behind bars, and a man was talking to me. I later found out he was a county health doctor. And said, son, said, we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you. Now, I didn't know what he meant by that, but I had long stopped since eating. And I thought maybe I was going to one of those places to taper off and, sit in a lawn chair and sip a little and on some soft green grass. And that's not where I went. And in the state of North Carolina, the state hospital is called Dix Hill. Well, it's an insane asylum is what it is. And, I've often said I, too, found my thrill on Dix Hill. That's what, I was sent to Dix Hill. I was just right at 27 years of age. And I never want to get my first trip to Dix Hill as long as I live. I got there the first day, and I was committed is what would happen. And they put me in the inebriate ward. I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded academic to me. And so I adjusted to that environment. The people in that ward, they chase squirrels most of the time. They'd run under the beds, under the tables, and all up and down the walls. And so I started chasing squirrels, too, and never caught any. I come close a couple of times. But after I'd been in there, I guess it was about 2 weeks, one day they came and got me, And I was really out of my mind part of the time, delirium tremens. They carried me down to the basement of this building. They called it Skid Row. And what it was a bunch of cells that had padded cells, and they took the clothes away from you and locked you up and let you have your running fits. And now that was a cure for alcoholism in North Carolina in 1956. And I was exposed to it. And I never want to forget it as long as I live. Days later, when I got through having my running fits, they gave my clothes back to me, put me up in the ward with the rest of the drunks, and then I was allowed to do the only thing I could do for 30-some-odd days. I looked around, and there was nobody there my age. Nobody. The men were a lot older. And I remember one night they were playing, a bunch of men that were playing poker. They were using matchsticks for chips. And as they were playing cards, they began to discuss the reason they were there. One man spoke up and says, I'm here because my wife wanted to get rid of me. That kind of rung a bell with me, you know. I thought my mother wanted to get rid of me. And as the truth is known, my mother had spent thousands of dollars on me and did the only thing she knew to do. And then I heard a man speak up, and I can see his face just as clear as it was 50-some years ago. This man spoke up and says, I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. One thing rang in my mind, and it rung in my mind for quite a while until I got sober. That was comparing my drinking with my father's drinking. And the truth was known, my father was a much better man drinking in his career than I ever hoped to be, because I had a lot of trouble down the line after that. The first time I left Dix Hill, I'd been there 30-some-odd days, and I didn't have anywhere to go. I'd lost everything I'd accumulated since I'd graduated from college, the bank accounts, the home, the cars, everything. And that marriage was a long time ago, and I don't even call it a marriage. But everything. So what do? Well, you do the only thing you can do. You go back home. Go back home to mother. And that's what I did. And my mother took me in, and they got together, and you know who they are. They are those kin folks that put you in room, and they put you in another, and begin to talk about the problem you are. And the end result was my mother said, he stays here. And I stayed there. And it was suggested maybe I should go see the family doctor because he was always worried about my nerves. And so I went to see the doctor. And he had no knowledge of alcoholism or drug addiction. And I don't know anything about drugs, but I know an awful lot about tablets. And the good doctor gave me some tablets to take, and you talking about being loose. I was getting dangerous taking those things because I was running around a crowd at night I'd been in school with, and, you know, eating the big steaks and partying, and they were drinking. But I was taking my medicine, and I was usually in worse shape than they were. And I'd been at home 9 weeks, a little over 9 weeks, and they passed that bottle. They had passed a bottle before, and I wouldn't take a drink. But this particular night, they passed that bottle, and you know what happened. I took a drink, and I went back to the place I said, and I would go again as long as I live, back to Dix Hill. I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months. On account of one fact, although I didn't know it then, I'd become an alcoholic as I know an alcoholic today. I'd take one drink, and I can no longer guarantee you my behavior. And that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. The last time I went back to Dix Hill, I tried drinking on top of antabuse. And I'm here to tell you it don't work. If you want a quick death, drink enough of it and enough antabuse, and you will succeed. And this time they put me in the nut part of the bug house instead of the drying out part. And this is where I found out a life that I never existed before, where it was straight, you know, in a bed in a straight jacket. How you live better electrically, I found out about that too. And I never want to forget it as long as I live. There's a word, and you hear it a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear it a lot outside in civilian life, the word coincidence. But we have a lot of coincidences in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of coincidences happened to me before I ever got here. And a coincidence happened that day, one day at Dix Hill, for some strange reason. They came and got me out of that nut ward and carried me back over to the building with the rest of the rummies. And that's where I was. Now, I'd been there so much as a patient, but they more or less made me an honorary attendant. I worked in the kitchen and worked in the cafeteria, and I was allowed to go get the mail at the main building every day, and had two assistants that went with me in case there was heavy work. And one day we decided we would escape. Don't want to sound dramatic, but that's what it was. And back then it was like cops and robbers. It really was. We went over that fence that morning. And that afternoon, we were in downtown Raleigh in the old Andrew Johnson Hotel. I'll never forget it. Hotel had been torn down for years, but we'd got a jug and was in our room, sitting back enjoying it, and the 6 o'clock news come on. And you know that streamer at the bottom when it's a hurricane or something, national disaster. One came across the bottom and says, 3 criminal and insane have just escaped from Dix Hill. And one of the fellows said, wonder who the hell it is. Sure enough, in a matter of moments, there they were, bop, 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 3 pictures of us, still pictures. God, one fellow, he started crying, and he ran out the door, and we haven't seen him since. I don't even know what happened to him. This fits some years ago. And he left, and my other friend, we came to the conclusion that since we were gangsters, we had better split up. And so we did. And the next morning, I was on the streets in Raleigh, and a friend of my mother that knew me and knew my background and a lot about my life, put me on a Greyhound bus and sent me back to my hometown, a place called Roanoke Rapids down in northeastern North Carolina, about 5 miles from the state line of Virginia. And I got home, and unbeknownst to me, I later found out, my mother was in Richmond with a nervous breakdown in the hospital. And I'd been at home about a week, and they brought her home and found me. Now, this is on the right side of town and all that stuff, and I'd been bumming off the neighbors, getting money from them, and taking advantage of some friends of my mother. And that's when they did get together that afternoon. They at that time were my 2 sisters and a friend of the family, like a father to me, and they put me in one room, cracked that door, and they began to talk about how much they loved me and what they had to do. And when I walked in the room I was in, and they had a wad of money. They had already planned it. I knew that. And they told me, says, if we want you to leave this part of the country, you're killing mother. We don't want you here anymore. We want you to leave this part of the country and start a new life. Ever how you want to do it. And here's a start. And it was enough to go. At that time, I could have gone to the West Coast and lived good for a period of time. And when I saw the green, I began to think it was a good idea. You know how we are. A little green on my hip. And sure enough, I left home that afternoon, but I didn't go very far. I pulled into a neighboring town 4 miles from home in an old hotel, a railroad town called Weldon, where the Atlantic coastline, the seaboard met, and was a railroad town is what it was, and pulled into the old Weldon Hotel. Had a lot of friends there for a while, and when the money ran out, friends kind of disappear. But I did the same thing that I'd always done before. If I needed money, I'd write a check. And so, no, none of you never had any problem like that. But so that afternoon, I went over to my hometown. A friend of the family was in business. I bought an outboard motor. I didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor. And, you know, write a big check, get the change, pick up the motor later. And they called my mother the next day to tell her that my motor was ready. And, God, she put two and two together. And the next day, that afternoon, John Law was there and carried me back to my hometown, put me in jail in my hometown, 3 blocks from my mother's home, and nobody had anything to do with me. And I was in jail. Every night, all the drunks were gone the next morning, except me. And I got to Raising Hell down there one night, and I got the jailer down there. I said, I want to talk to my attorney. He says, who is your attorney? I told him. He said, talk to you. All you want to is the next cell block. And sure enough, he was. And maybe it's a coincidence. This man later found Alcoholics Anonymous, became a member of the state legislature, and died sober. But he couldn't help me that night. And but the next day after this little encounter, I had to stand up, go upstairs and stand trial in court of law, something I didn't know I'd done in a blackout. 2 days later, I had to go somewhere else to stand in trial for something I didn't know I'd done in a blackout. Prosecuting attorney was my mother's next-door neighbor, and he didn't seem to know who I was. And matter of fact, nobody seemed to know who I was. And the end result of the whole thing was, I told you, I just kept moving east. Well, you've heard of the Great Dismal Swamp, I guess. That's where I was. I was put on a chain gang down the Great Dismal Swamp. Trying to do the, I never knew all those bottles that I threw in the ditch, I was going to have to come back and pick them up, but that's what I did. And I worked hard and I've worked in my life, and I was ashamed of it, always been ashamed of it, but I really believe this was part of me getting Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous when I was in Dix Hill. Fellas would come over on Sunday afternoon in Raleigh and put on a meeting. I was a joker in the back of the room and Raising Hell and making fun of them, drinking the coffee and eating the donuts. You know, I was about sober 2 years when I realized one night, every Sunday those fellows left, but I stayed. You know how we are. But that was the first time I heard about AA, and the second time was a little bit later on, after I served my time on good behavior. I came back to my hometown, the only place I had to go again, and my mother took me back in again against the wishes of some of my kinfolk, my two sisters, and but she took me in anyway. And that's when I made a vow I'd do something for her. I wouldn't drink anymore for her. I don't recommend this before AA or after AA, doing it for somebody else. The end result of my second encounter was I'd heard about AA in this prison camp. There was a young superintendent, and he had a young wife, and on Saturday afternoon I had to cut his grass, and they let me have dinner with him on Sunday night, and I always looked forward to that. And he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe that was my problem. I told him, no, I was too young to be an alcoholic. And when I got out of serving my time, I was back home. My mother took me in, and she had made arrangements for an old-timer in my hometown. He's dead and gone now, to take me down to Rich Square, North Carolina, to talk to a man that had gone out in the Akron, Cleveland area and found sobriety. He was a very successful lawyer, lost his practice. And Dr. Bob got hold of him and got him sober and helped him out. And he came back to North Carolina and started his practice again, and he was very successful. in his sobriety in law practice. And as a matter of fact, he was our second state delegate. And his name was, I can't even think of his name now. But anyway, Vernon Strickland was his name. And Vernon sat down and talked to me that night. He carried me down there, and he took time to talk to me. Told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, what it could do for him, and so forth. Now, again, I told him I was too young to be an alcoholic. And Vernon gave me some advice. I've never forgotten it. He said, son, I'll tell you what. You keep drinking and be patient, and you'll find out. And that's what I did. And stranger than it may seem, about a year and a half later, that's when I found Alcoholics Anonymous. At this time, when I got home, it was suggested maybe I should go to work. It had been a while, and I didn't think I'd get a job coaching the state of North Carolina. So through an agency up in Richmond, Virginia, I was interviewed in the state of Maryland, the state of Virginia, for about six opportunities to go back into coaching and teaching. And one Thursday afternoon, I wound up in Roanoke, Virginia. And a man began to talk to me about opening the head. It was in August. They were getting desperate. And he wanted some he wanted some facts about me and my resume, and he got on the phone, called these people, and I remember my mother was with me, and I said, well, it's all over now. And he made us sit there, and he came back later and said, I understand you had a problem with drinking one time, but you haven't had any problem lately. And it had been about 4 months I hadn't drank. And I said, that's right. Well, he hired me. Now, I had a fresh new start in life in spite of where I'd been. And you talk about the miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle is about to happen. Because I got back to Roanoke 2 days later to take this job, a place to stay, had a nice place home, a nice home to stay in. But I checked into the big hotel on the hill and started writing big checks, having a big time. I was able to work 5 days. The sixth working day, I got back to the morning drink, and I lost a job in a period of 2 weeks. And the end result was my mother got in touch with me halfway this drunk, and she gave me the greatest gift she'd ever given me since the day I was born. That's when she kicked me out of her life. And I knew she meant it. I knew she meant it. And I wound up on the streets in Roanoke, Virginia, doing the best I could. On Sunday morning, September the 11th, 1957, I was in a back alley in downtown Roanoke, what they call the market, which was Skid Row, getting ready to take a drink of liquor, and the thought occurred to me, my God, I'm going to die in this back alley from what I'm doing. I'm going to die right here. And I don't know about you, I remember when my moment of truth came. I knew whatever what I was doing, it was going to kill me right there. And I'd lost all, respect that anybody had for me, and I guess I lost all my self-respect. But I guess I had enough that I just didn't want to die in that back alley. And I prayed out to a God that I knew as a kid for some help. Maybe it was a coincidence, I don't know. But the man that had hired me had been looking for me for a little over a week. He didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or drunks. He just wanted to help a human being. And he had talked to my mother and found out she wasn't going to help me. And he was interested in trying to help me. And he found me that Sunday morning in that back alley. Carried me to his home. Got in touch with a man that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was carried in downtown Roanoke that Sunday afternoon to a clubhouse called the Easy Does It Club. The Easy Does It Club. And I never want to forget it as long as I live. I'd gotten to the point that I couldn't black out anymore. I hurt all over. My hair hurt. My toenails hurt. Tired of the high cost of low living, and that's what it got to. And they carried me up those steps, literally carried me up the steps. And as I got to the head of the steps, people began to look me over. You know, we say we don't look them over when they come in. By God, you look me over. And as the members were talking to these two men that carried me, it was an old gentleman standing right in the corner, kind of did this, and I waddled over to him. He put his arm around me. His son said, I want to tell you something. He said, all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. And I never want to forget what that man told me, although I didn't know the truth many of it at that time. And he was telling me, unbeknownst to me, the first few lines of chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail that has followed, that has thoroughly followed our path. Old man John rang my bell. He really did. And I knew, for some reason or another, that if I could do what he told me, just stay there, that I didn't have to go out that door again the way I came in. And I got nervous and I started shaking a little, and I said something about a drink, and they said, "Oh, no, we don't do it that way." I said, "You get too bad, we're going to get you a doctor." Then I said something about some tablets, and I thought I'd started a revolution. And they said, "Drink the coffee. Drink the coffee." Now, I drank the coffee, and what I'm about to say is no reflection of who made coffee here, but I'll tell you something. There are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee that don't have any business doing it. And and that was one of those times. That ropey stuff, I thought you had to drink it. And I sat down and drank that coffee the whole afternoon, got sick from it. They carried me to my first meeting that night. And I don't know what went on. I remember a guy talking. I remember looking out and wondering how far it was to the ground. I went out to wonder. But what I do remember most of all is strangers walking up to me after the meeting, putting arms around me and said, "We love you, and we understand, and you're going to be all right." That's all they told me. They didn't ask me where I came from, if I had insurance. They didn't ask me a damn thing. They said, "We love you, and you're going to be all right." That's the magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the beginning of the miracle, when people tell you that. And that night, three men got me a room at the YMCA and stayed with me all night long, talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety and telling me their story. And I remember when I said the next morning when it was getting daybreak, said, "Dave," said, "all we try to do is just try to do it a day at a time." First time I ever heard it was that morning. It wasn't planned, but I heard it. And then I began to think, well, maybe I can do it a day at a time. But somewhere in the dark recesses of my mind, I knew one fact. Then and as I know it tonight, I had to be around you to do it. I had to be around you to do it. And that's the way I feel about it tonight. That's the reason I'm here. I still got to be around you to maintain what I have. And I never want to forget it. My sponsor, I met him the next morning at the Easy Does It Club. Asked me a lot of questions. I shot some lies at him, and he finally said, "Look, stop. Let's tell the truth." And that's what I had to do, and got honest. And he found me a place to stay, a boarding house where there was six of us alcoholics. Each one of us had a room. And we had our meals there, and I don't know who paid for it the first few months. In this boarding house, and out of those six men, including myself, two of us are sober today. And one's still drinking, about dying, calls me every Christmas, collect. Wants to know why I could do it and he couldn't. The other two of them committed suicide, went going back to drinking when I'm at 27 years of sobriety. So I learned a lot from those men. And I started doing what I was asked to do. And it was about this time I met my first real wife, Sue. She was an anesthesiologist there in Roanoke, and I just happened to meet her. And she took a liking to me, and we began to date a little after I had some sobriety. And this was a God gift to me at that time. I got active in the group, I thought, and doing things that they asked me to do. They had a conference room in the old meeting place, and it was at the back. They called it a conference room. I called it an inventory room because they'd call you in there and sit you down and take your inventory. What do you like, the old time? Well, you like it or not, just tell you. And didn't look forward to that a lot. And I'd been sober about 9 months, and they let me talk. If you had less than a year sobriety, the steering committee had to approve it. And they let me talk, and they approved it. And one of the fellows at the house got drunk. They brought him to the meeting and propped him up in the back. And I started a talk on how not to slip. Never heard of one being done, but I started one. And as I was talking, I heard somebody say, "Sit down." And I kept on talking. Finally, he said, "Sit down." And you know, when you're stark raving sober, you don't hear them too good. And finally, he came to the podium. and grabbed me by the elbow and took me down the center aisle, and everybody's eyes were big. I mean, they're looking at this spectacle and wondering what in the world. And well, the thought was going through my mind, my God, I got too much power for him tonight, and he don't want me to overdo it. That's all it is. Now, you can begin to understand what kind of predicament I was getting in. And I was hanging around a bunch of people that were telling me to take the first step, and that's really all I needed. The dust would fall in place, the rest of it. And then one day, after I had a year of sobriety, they called me in that room one day and talked to me about my program. And the end result was they told me unless I got a hold of the 12 steps and got honest with myself, I was going to get drunk. Now, this is a hell of a thing to tell the backbone of the group that is going to get drunk, but that's what they were telling me. And I got mad, and I got ready to tear out the room, and my sponsor said, I want to ask you one question before you leave. And he says, when was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety? And that made me mad, and I went back to the boarding house. And I don't know what stage of sponsorship you were in, but you went, one time you wanted to do something to him. I know that. And I wanted to do something to him, and the thought of taking a drink didn't occur to me. That wasn't in my mind, but I went back to that boarding house. I sat down. I wrote a written resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll just resign. As I was doing this composition, I began to hear his voice. It became an echo. When was the last time you thanked God for a day? And the end result, I went into a bathroom and looked at myself in a mirror for the first time in my adult life and realized that I was just a speck on this universe, that the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I tried everything else. And so the next night, I went back to my home group, and I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. And every year I get a chip, I try to rejoin, I rededicate myself, because it meant a lot to me. And it was also about this time that I've often said I learned much more from people with less education than I. The man who solved my employment problem had a third grade education. They called me in that conference room one night. There was a doctor, a lawyer, a registered nurse, my sponsor, and Red. Red was a sign painter with a third grade education. And they began to talk about what I ought to do about my employment. And here they come with all this stuff. And then finally Red speaks up. He said, Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life. Well, hell, nobody ever explained to me that way before. And sure enough, through Red's help and Sue's, they carried me over to district engineer the next day, and I was interviewed. AA had told me, said, tell them the whole truth. Tell them the whole load. And I got in there and talked to the district engineer, and I told him everything. He sat there in complete astonishment. I mean, when you tell the damn truth, they know it's the truth. And he sat there, and he couldn't believe it, I don't think. And finally he said, son, if you're willing to help yourself, we're willing to help you too. I got sober in September. This was the middle of December, just before Christmas. And he said, when can you go to work? I said, well, I got a lot of business to tend to. I was scared to death. And I said, first of February, I can go. He said, fine, you come on back to first of February, and we'll put you to work. Went out to the car and read to see what happened. You get the job? Yep. When you go to work? I told him what happened. They carried my butt right back, and I went to work that afternoon. And that's what I've always said. AA in action is what it is. And this was the beginning of a life that I had some success in. And later on, because of that marriage I had when I was drinking so heavy, and that drunken marriage, I had to go back to my home state to get a divorce. I couldn't get one in Virginia, so I could marry Sue. And I went back to Raleigh and went to Raleigh in 1959. As a matter of fact, June the 15th, I'll be in Raleigh 50 years. And a man, my sponsor, had arranged for a man to take me over when I got there, a man by the name of Tom Burrell. Tom, some of the people in the old Atlanta people knew him. He was a member of a group down here at one time. Tom was a New Yorker. He was one of the first 100. As a matter of fact, he replaced Dr. Bob on the old Alcoholic Foundation when Dr. Bob died as a trustee. And Tom was a man that knew that book And when I moved to Raleigh, I'd ask people questions to let them know how smart I was. And Tom said, read the book, and then we'll talk. Read the book, and then we'll talk. And he got me. He's the man that got me service work. And he's the man that gave me a great lesson about standing behind one of these things. I remember I'd been sober 4 or 5 years and going to some of these retreats and conventions, and these dudes were just talking, and they got through, and everybody hugged and clapped and kissed them and all that, and it kind of appealed to me. And so one night I told Tom I want to talk to him after the meeting. He said, what's the problem? I said, Tom, I think I'm a convention speaker. I can't repeat what he said from the podium, but I'll tell you this. A moratorium was put on my speaking for close to 2 years. He said, you do not tell your story in any meeting. I'll tell you when. You discuss all you want to, but you don't tell your story. And it was about close to 2 years later, he called me one day and said, come over to the house. And when he asks you to come to the house, you know you're in trouble. And he was one of these that sat you down, and he stood up and talked down at you. And I sat down, and he stood up. And he said, Dave, you're going down to Columbia, South Carolina, to talk at a state convention. You do this, you do this, you do this. Before you go, there's something I want to tell you. You're going as a damn substitute. I can't go. They asked me to go first. I can't go. And you're going as a damn substitute. And don't you ever forget it as long as you live. And so I don't know how many you got before me, but I get behind here and I just say I'm a substitute and it works fine for me. He was a great man. And because of him, I got to know a lot of people in the New York area and their staff members and all that traveling around with him. And later on, Sue and I were married, and I had success in the job I was in. I got really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been there ever since in Raleigh. I don't know about you. It might be. I know some young people here tonight, and you're wondering about this thing. Wonder if it will work. It will work if you want it to work. It will work if you want it to work. And all you got to do is be honest with yourself. I know I heard a man years ago speak from the podium. He said, you know, when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I am the truth. I believe it's from this source and this root that we inherited the program we call Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've not seen enough in my time and age not only to believe, but to know that there is a power behind the universe that helps, ready to help us if we're willing to help ourselves. In my early sobriety, I call it the man upstairs. And tonight, as I stand before you, I call it the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. The God that I found in AA. The God that I found through you by your love for me. I'm one of these people that believe that I was loved sober. I really do believe it. I believe I was loved sober. So many people went out of the way to try to help me. And as I stand here tonight and see a new man or woman to come in, and I say, God, I hope they get the same thing I do. I really hope. And it's our job. You know, I talked earlier about it. I've been sober for a few years. But I'm not an old-timer, in spite of soon be 52 years. But the old-timers are the ones that were here when I got here that had 20 years of sobriety. An old-timer, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, 20 years was an old-timer. They are the men that I look up to. They are the ones that gave it to me. And I know how hard they worked at it. And some of you remember, though, I call them the circuit riders. And remember old Burton Crawford from Kilgore, Texas, used to come here a lot and talk. And Burton gave the best, you know, we always talk about sobriety dates. Burton had the best one I ever heard of. He had been sober for a number of years. Burton would get to the podium. He said, my name's Burton Crawford. I'm from Kilgore, Texas. And I've been sober ever since I can remember. Well, you think about it. That's about all of us. We've been sober since we can remember. So if you're new in the program and you want sobriety, work at it. Find you some body around you in AA and find you a sponsor and work at this thing. Go to meetings. Now, I don't know what time I started. But like I said, it don't mean nothing. But now I'm about to burn up. I'll be honest with you. It won't be long before I'm going to sit down. And my former wife, Sue, died after living with me for 35. She's experienced 35 years of my sobriety and marriage. And I was very lucky to have a woman like her. And I've often said that God closes doors and he opens doors. And he opened the door later on after Sue died. A lady came in my life. There's some in this room that know her, Julie. Julie will soon have 27 years of sobriety on the 23rd. A lady from Richmond, Virginia. I'd met her at Blackstone and fell in love with her. And we got married. As a matter of fact, the 1 year of sobriety, I was down here, and she was with me at this roundup. And as a result of this marriage, something else has come into my life. Four grandchildren that have been born. And, of course, I never experienced anything like this in my first marriage. And here I am, a granddaddy. They know I'm a drunk and found a way to stay sober. And one of them heard me talk. And he clapped when I got through. I don't know if he know what I said or not. But and she's got grown kids that have been a blessing to me. And I know it's another life that I found as a result of this program, The Miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what it is. It's a miracle. In spite of this God-given sobriety, there's still some things I have to do. And sometimes I have to remind myself, you remember when I came to you, I told you I was willing to go in any length to get this program. Willing any length to get it. And sometimes I have to remind myself of that when the phone rings in the middle of the night and some guy or gal wants some help. And the thought is always there, I wonder if they can wait after breakfast. And then another thought comes. And that thought is, those three men, that first night, they didn't drop me off and said, we'll see you after breakfast. No, it don't work that way. It don't work that way. And so I feel like that I just have to renew what I told you I would do when I got to you. And I'm often reminded of it when that phone rings sometime in the middle of the night and I get up and go. That's what it's all about. The second thing I have to do is I have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where it's at. That's where we survive among individual egos. And it's the little people. You know, I got people in my group can stand behind this podium and make a better talk than me, but they just don't know how to do it. By that, I mean just revealing themselves. And the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous that we've had. I have to laugh at some of the experiences I've had in sobriety. We had a guy in our group named, I hope I can talk about him without getting too serious, but his name was Henry. Henry was he was a graduate of the University of North Carolina. And I don't know whether that's plus or minus. I won't get into that. But anyway, Henry had trouble staying sober, but he died with 26 years of sobriety. And Henry used to get drunk, and his wife would call us and say, he's down at so-and-so. Would you mind getting him to bring him home? And we would do it. And then one night he called, and she said, he's down at so-and-so. Would you mind bringing him home? And we said we would. She said, no. Said, I've thought about it more. I don't want him home. You do what you want to with him. Well, we had a fellow that worked at the funeral home. And name was John. So we carried Henry down to the funeral home. John said, leave him down here tonight. I'll take care of him. Put him in one of them, you know, in the display room where all the caskets are. Put him in one of them caskets. And he'll sleep it off. And sure enough, we did. And we left. And, of course, John was telling the story later, and it seemed as though the next morning Henry woke up and riled up and said, where am I? And John said, Henry, you're dead. And Henry said, how long have I been dead? And he said, you've been dead 3 days. And so Henry thought a minute. He said, well, what are you doing here? And John said, I'm dead, too. And I said, how long you been dead? And he said, I've been dead 10 days. Henry says, well, you ought to know where we can find a drink of liquor. Now, it's these people like this that I got to be around and have a little fun, really and true. There was a couple in my group. Some of you might have known them. I don't know. They're both dead now, Vernon and Gertrude. I sponsored both of them, and they couldn't keep driver's license to save their lives. And both of them had lost license, and I would make them call me to pick them up. I wouldn't call them and ask them, did they want a ride? And they would call me finally and say, would you mind picking us up? And they'd been married for about 16 years. And one night, it was Christmas Eve, I'll never forget it, and we were on the 8th step, and we were talking about it, going home, and Gertrude turned to Vernon. Now, they'd been married 16 years. And she said, "Vernon, when are you going to make some amends to me, honey?" Talking about the 8th step. Never forgot what Vernon said. He said, "Honey, you're not even on my list." And now, this is people that, I got to be around people like this to laugh like this. I really have. Doing those devilish things, you know how mean we can be. The third thing I have to do is I have to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it tells me in my book and your book that we're granted a daily reprieve contingent among the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I happen to know, as long as I've been trying to work these 12 steps, that my spiritual condition has much improved. I really know that for a fact. And the fourth thing I have to do, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, some days I just have to hang on and do the best I can. They told me years ago, nothing's so bad it won't get better if you just have to hang on. And it's from this experience, you know, I feel like that yesterday is my experience, and tomorrow is my hope. And today is going from one to the other and doing the best I can. And I really believe that as long as I walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny, that I too will be allowed another day of sobriety. That's what it's all about. The miracle, my mother knows it's a miracle. My mother lived to see me sober 37 years before she died. And she wouldn't have nothing to do with y'all in the beginning. She couldn't understand how I could do it for a bunch of strangers and I couldn't do it for her. And she later became one of the greatest friends that Alcoholics Anonymous ever had. And life is good. Alcoholics Anonymous is good. And the miracle is here. And you know, and I know, there are going to be many more miracles that walk in that door in years to come and days to come. I could have stood up here a while ago, and I'm going to close with a passage from the, well, I admit it's from the big book. For a while, I wouldn't tell anybody where it was from. I wanted to leave the impression with my own words. You know how we are. But it's mighty powerful. It's because of this that I feel like the greatest thing that has ever happened to me in my lifetime is Alcoholics Anonymous. And the longer I stay sober, the greater it becomes. But the story goes like this, and you know what I'm talking about. And it's probably your story. It's mine, I know. And it goes something like this. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is really an affirmation of truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything I need, I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you very much.